countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Caller Gas, celebrating 80 years, bringing energy to Ireland's homes and businesses.
It's a lovely morning, actually, now.
Oh, no, just God above, just heaven. The weather has been mixed this week, but there have been spells of sunshine that tell us that spring is arriving. I'm on the Ward family farm here in North County Dublin, and I'm heading straight for the lambing sheds to see what's been happening there over the past 24 hours.
Yeah, hello.
Lawrence and Denise have a mixed enterprise, including 600 ewes. Lambing has started and will continue until the end of March. They're expecting up to 1,000 lambs to be born on this farm this spring.
So these were born this morning there around 8:30, 9:30. So she's, as you see there, she's just licking them now and cleaning them off and all the rest. And there now, that lamb there is getting ready, trying to find his first suck, trying to get to the teat to have the first suck. Mm-hmm. She'll be there all day today. She'll get her nuts and water now later on, and she'll be there for today, and then we'll move her tomorrow. So we will.
You have two here that were born this morning. One is looking a little bit more fragile than the other, and it's very... covered in brown and white.
There would be a little bit stressed. You can still see the bit of blood in this one here that she's still licking. I'll just take this lamb out. You can feel how wet this lad is, actually.
Yeah.
You can feel how wet he still is.
Oh, he is very wet.
Yeah, so she's licking him there. See, that lamb is starting to get his first suck. So nature will follow its course now, and they'll find the teat there and they'll suck. So they're getting their first suck of colostrum, and then she'll come to her milk, natural milk after that. And once they get the first suck into them, they normally lie down, fall asleep and rest, and they're fine. And come back in half an hour, their bellies are full, just lift them up, their bellies are full, rub their belly, you know, they're happy, you know.
Are these her first lambs?
No, they could be, or they could be maybe her fourth crop of lambs, yeah.
Lawrence, in terms of these lambs, how long will they be here in the sheds before they actually reach the market?
We used to always aim lambs in Ireland for the Easter market. Mm-hmm. But we don't aim it now because we have an overlap of last year's lambs, hoggets, as we call them now, still in the market around Easter time. And they would be, those hoggets would be lambs that would have been born maybe March, April, or May down the country, maybe on the hills of Sligo, wherever, Mayo, that country, late lambing. No problem with that, but it has spoiled the real Easter lamb, spring lamb production. So now what we are aiming our markets for are the Ramadan festivals, the Muslim big festivals. Mm. They would take a huge percentage of lamb. And only for them, I'd say, we would be in trouble because the quantities they take is unbelievable. And they have, I think, 2, maybe 3 festivals a year. So they have. So in about 120 days, he should be all going well on your plate.
Don't say that.
So these are the sheep in here at present are all on the point of lambing due to lamb on as we're talking here. So you'll see a lot of them springing down with the big elders coming behind them. They're all now due to lamb probably from any day.
And how would you know when a ewe is about to...
She would show signs. She'd be going round in a circle. She'd be pawing the ground like that, going round looking at her tail, chasing her tail. She would then put out probably a very small little water bag, and then she'd be anxious, she'd be getting up, lying down. So she'd make her bed for lambing, and then eventually she'd lie down and she'd try and have the lamb. Or if not, we might have to just go assist her just to help her for the final push or two. But 9 out of 10 have their own lambs.
There's nobody walking around in a circle or stamping their feet at the moment anyway. There must be many sleepless nights in your house.
Yeah, there are a few, but not too many, Marty. Not too many. There's a few little tricks up your sleeve that for some people they work, for some people they don't work. But one is if you feed them late at night, they probably won't lamb then till probably about maybe 12 hours later. Certainly till 6 o'clock the following morning anyway. Mm. So later you feed them. The second trick is maybe just have your lights slightly dimmed in the evening time. Don't have too much strong light in your shed at night time and have it like nature's way that it gets dark in the evening time. They're not inclined then to lamb, they kind of just lie down and rest as well. And there's a few little bits and pieces you can do with them. So, but yes, nature will take its course. If they decide they want to lamb at 3 o'clock in the morning, of course they'll lamb.
Good, good, good.
This is the flock manager coming now.
At this busy time of the year, Tama Harbour lends a helping hand.
When I left school, I went to work with a man that had 1,000 ewes, and that was back in the 50s, and that was a lot of sheep then.
In North Dublin?
Oh, yeah.
And did you work all your life?
Ah, no. I was there for 12 years, and I went to the airport, and then I retired out of the airport.
Did you?
After 30 years, and I'm up to this man, and I'm up here about 20, so.
My God above.
Had a great life.
Plenty more to come, for God's sake.
Please God.
Absolutely.
Please God. Please
so
God.
Can I ask, how old are you now?
I'm 83.
Sheep farming changed an awful lot since you were school and you started with Stephen.
They were all like lambing out that time. Lambed out in the field, out there in the middle of the night with a lamp, a tilly lamp or these lamps. Not the storm lamps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know. So the doves and sheep farming are your two passions?
Oh, why not? How long it'll last, though, I don't know.
Either
the sheep or the doves.
Nice to meet you, Tom.
And I'm delighted to meet you.
Good to see you.
To me, it's exciting to see all lambs born. I always look forward to this time of the year because there's a new start, there's a new beginning, there's a new growth. So you're always fascinated to see what type of lambs are going to be born, what colour they are, their nature, their characteristics and all that. So yes, every lamb born, you sort of love seeing it. Don't get too attached because you can't. So you have to accept ups and downs of it. But at the end of the day, because every year is different, there's a new year, you're not carrying on from last year, a whole new flock of sheep coming in, lambs coming in, it's new challenges. It's a great motivation to get you going, you know. So it's...
And that was Lawrence Ward from North County Dublin talking to me. And yes, Tom, who's assisting with the lambing, is 83 years of age. And if you do want to meet Tom, he'll be on Hill 16 tonight supporting the Duffs. And Lawrence asked me to remind you that if you own a dog, please keep it under strict control at this time of year. If your dog strays into a sheep pasture, it can cause mayhem for the pregnant ewes and defenceless newborn lambs. And I have to say, I had a beautiful, beautiful morning with Lawrence in North County Dublin. Dancing with the Stars is on tonight, Saturday night, yes, on RT1 television at just 6:30. It's a change in the schedule and the dancers will be changing partners as well. Both changes for 1 week only. So it's been a shorter week for the Stars to rehearse, to learn their new routines and to get fitted into those glorious costumes. Aidan Fogarty, former Kilkenny hurler, 8-time All-Ireland medal winner and now a Dancing with the Stars man himself. You're very welcome to Countrywide Studio. Good morning.
Thanks, Marty. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. 8-time All-Ireland medalist Aidan Fogarty, known affectionately as Taggy. Where did the name Taggy come from?
Taggy, yeah. It's a nice one to start off with. Actually, primary school, Marty. My brother was named Froggy and went to primary school. And I started then after being the younger brother. I was nicknamed Tadpole. So Tadpole then turned into Taddy, which turned into Taggy along the years. Yeah, so simple and so crazy. But after sticking over the years, if I go back to Kilkenny, if someone called me Aidan, I'd have to look twice, really.
Really?
I really would. It's just Taggy has stuck with me and it is what it is now.
It is what it is. And yeah. You don't mind?
I don't mind, no.
I met a former teammate of yours. I won't say his name. Well, actually, it was Richie Hogan. And he tells me you were a great mover and shaker on the floor when you were on holidays.
Oh, Richie. Yeah, thanks for that, Richie. it was actually a gas when I got the phone call to do it. Out of all little Kenny lads, I would have been maybe the one that was up dancing maybe on dance-offs and night-outs and, you know, for a bit of crack and things like that. If there was anything going on like that, I would have been called in. They said, oh, call in Taggy there and they might do a busting out move here and there. So I suppose that's what Richie Hogan is talking about. But that's very late at night, Marty, with a bit of Dutch courage in me as well. But this is a totally different scenario I'm in.
So which is more nerve-wracking, putting on the black and amber for Kilkenny and All-Ireland hurling final or putting on your costume to dance with Dancing with the Stars?
I'd have to say the costume of Dancing with the Stars because...
I can understand that.
Yeah, you know where I'm coming from.
I know
there,
exactly
Marty,
what you're talking about.
The thing is, like, I've always played hurling. I've played hurling since 6 or 7 years of age. So I'm so used to talking out in dressing rooms. I'm so used to playing with Kilkenny. I got used to playing with the big days. Obviously, when I started out first, they were very nerve-wracking, but I got to control that. I got to know how the routine was. And it was just something that was inbred. It was in my blood. Hurling was in my blood. I knew what to do. This is just so much out of my comfort zone. It's so not what I always do. And it's to a bigger audience on a Sunday night. You have less time to train. You only have, say this week, we only have 3 days to perform a dance tonight in front of whatever, is it 500,000 could be watching it? It
easily.
Depends on the show. And it's just so much not me and it's so awkward for me. So what I try to do during the week is I try just put in the hours as much as I can and try to perform as the best I can then on the night.
And I know what you mean when you say you'd go up on the floor because I'd be the same. I'd have an old jive or a set or whatever. Mm-hmm. But Dancing with the Stars is slightly different. When they say jive, you're talking about frame and everything else. So it's much more difficult.
Much more difficult. Like, we can all dance, we can all have a bit of rhythm, but it's all so to the music. It's all a count. It's 1, 2, 3 up to 8, and then certain dances, then it changes back to 2, 3, 4. So you're counting constantly in your head, and you're trying to not count out loud because you're on television. You're trying to smile. You're trying to act the actual dance. You're trying to look like as if you're enjoying it, and you could be actually in pain because your body could be breaking down. So it's just all the emotions, and that's one thing actually. It's just all the emotions of the show. It's just surreal. I didn't expect it, to be honest.
No, and I mean, I'm used to the technology around, but when I went on the floor the first time, just to do the rehearsal, all I could hear was laughter, because all the cameramen, sound engineers, my friends and colleagues all started laughing. Yeah. And then I started to laugh. And suddenly you do realise you are outside your comfort zone, and this is the biggest challenge you will ever take.
It is, for sure, Marty, the biggest challenge I've ever taken on. It's the biggest risk I've taken on. It's the most grueling thing I've ever done. But in the same sentence, it's the most enjoyable, most fantastic, most surreal experience of my life because of that challenge, I suppose. I suppose when you challenge yourself in life, that's when you really enjoy it.
Now, you were always fit. I know you, obviously, as a hurler for many years. But you were always fit. But you lost weight.
Yeah, like, I would have been slim. I wouldn't have weight to lose, but I'm after losing 3/4 of a stone. I'm gone to nearly a stick and bone, you know, and I'm eating as much as I can when I can. That's another thing. Trying to eat is actually difficult because you're training so hard. Yeah. But I'm eating as much as I can. I'm eating McDonald's. I'm eating, like, crap that I never ate before because I need the calories. But it's just falling off me.
Yeah. Are you surprised at the reaction? I mean, I was down the Midlands yesterday driving through, and I could see Emily and Aidan. Are you surprised at the reaction? Are you overawed by it?
Yeah, I'm taken aback, to be honest. I suppose with Kilkenny, it's a team environment. You're shouting for a team. In this scenario, it's more about me. It's more of an individual thing. And I really am humbled, and I'm actually taken aback what's going on down below in my home club in the south, in Kilkenny. Just the people and the text messages I'm getting of support, because at the beginning they're kind of slagging me, but then they're just kind of saying, fair play to you, you're just doing brilliant and keep it going. And I just, it is a bit taken aback. I am a bit humbled by it all.
You have a great dancing partner, Emily Barker. I danced with her 2 years ago, tonight 2 years ago, Crocodile Rock by Elton John. They're still talking about it in dancing circles,
yeah, yeah.
You know, you can imagine.
They talked about it this week actually, Martin. Yeah, it's one of the standout moments of Dancing with the Stars all over the years.
The hardest part was getting out of the boat. But I mean, Emily is brilliant.
Fantastic, Marty. I couldn't have asked for a better partner. She's from Nottingham in England, and she's just so grounded, kind of like a country girl, which I am. I'm a country man. And she's just so humble and just so down to earth. And her way of teaching me is just so good. She's so supportive. She knows I've never done this again. And she knows that I'm putting in the effort. And once she sees me putting in the effort and putting in the hours, she's happy. And whenever we produce after that, then I'll be it.
But your idea for dancing, because you didn't know how to dance, and here it's a journey, that phrase, but it is true. So here's a big question for you. Who's the tougher boss, Emily Barker or Brian Cody?
That's a funny one, you should say that. I've often asked, were you afraid of Brian Cody? And I suppose the answer is, I'd be afraid to be dropped by Brian Cody. That's probably the answer. But Emily, I can't be dropped by Emily. She is stern, but I suppose they're similar in ways, because once they see you putting in the effort, as I've said already, they're just happy. And whatever your ability is after that, your ability is.
Back in 2006, you scored a cracking goal and you were man of the match in the All-Ireland Final. So what is the greater feeling? Scoring a goal in the All-Ireland Final in Croke Park, 82,300, or getting it right, getting it bang on for Dancing with the Stars?
God, they are so similar, Marty.
Yeah.
It is so similar. Like, I nailed, I think it was my second dance, the Foxtrot, and I was just so happy. It was just that moment. But I suppose if I really had to pick a moment, it is scoring that goal in 2006. It is something I dreamt about all my life as a young fella, playing out in the back garden, pretending to be DJ Carey and putting it into the back of the net between 80,000 people to a sport that I love. That was just the moment of the moments.
Well, you know, there are kids now in Kilkenny who want to be Taggy. They want to be Aidan Fogarty, not just to score goals, but a dancer
but
as
the
well.
The only thing is now, Marty, Brian won't be happy. They want to be dancers instead of hurlers.
I could even hear that in my voice, or his voice, I should say. You grew up on a farm, didn't you?
I did indeed, yeah. Yeah, I grew up on a farm all my life. So I know what it takes. And I know the brother now is probably calving cows at the minute. It's February to the end of March. And it's a tough work, but it's a very enjoyable. It's in the country. My father, the way it goes, my brother is the older brother, so we inherited the farm, and I had to go off and look for a job, and that's just the tradition of farming and things like that. So I really enjoyed it, and I suppose it gave me a good kind of a work ethic to go forward in life as well.
Now, I'm getting loads of texts, all of them from ladies who want to know, do you have a dancing partner for Valentine's night next Friday?
I don't indeed, no, no. I'm single, all right, yeah, but I haven't even thought about it, Marty.
You won't be single for long with Dancing with the Stars.
I'm just consumed by dancing, but no, I've no, no lady friends, I have no relationship, but...
My screen is lighting up here. But can I have Taggy's phone
you
number
might
here?
You a few of them numbers there, Marty, if you have them there, yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Aidan Fogarty, for joining us this morning. Your taxi awaits to whisk you off to rehearsals, and I know what that's like. And this is a very short week, and it's very difficult, isn't it?
Very short week. We only have 3 days, and the dance is difficult. So for everyone,
what are you dancing?
I'm dancing the cha cha cha.
Oh yeah,
yeah. So it's a really difficult technical dance, but everyone's in the same boat. We only had 3 days, so it's a bit rushed. The only thing, no one get voted off, but the votes carry through to next week.
Okay, well, Aidan Fogarty, thank you very much. Dancing with the Stars is on RT1 Television tonight at 6:35. There'll be voting, but no eliminations, so you can kind of enjoy it.
Yeah.
I'll be doing the commentary on Dublin versus Monaghan over on RT2, but I will catch up later on the RT player, I promise.
Brilliant.
Aidan Fogarty, lovely to have you on the programme.
Thanks for having me, Marty. Thank you very much.
Well, earlier this week, the Heritage Council presented their Heritage Hero Award to the Egan family from County Offaly for their preservation of a rare furnished farmhouse, which was their family home for generations. The farmhouse is known as Carrageen Farmhouse, and reporter Suzanne Campbell went to Birr to visit the Egan family, where Anna Marie told her about the house's new role as a heritage home place.
So this house is listed on the 1838 OS maps, and the family, my dad's grandparents and my dad's mom, were listed here on the 1901 census.
I'm near Birr, County Offaly, where Anna Maria Egan has brought me to Carrageen Farmhouse, the house her father grew up in. As it was never refurbished, it remains a valuable record of rural life of past generations.
We can track it back to the 1700s, where Dad's great-grandfather, he was born in 1799, so he lived here. My grand-aunt came back to live here in the 1990s, and she used to always say there were 6 generations of James Hineses that lived here in the house.
And they were farmers, I presume?
Yeah, it seems to be that there was always farming in the background, and even to this day, it still operates as a working farm here.
So if I can describe it to people, it's 3 windows in your door, kind of like the Irish cottages we would know, but the roof height is higher than normal, isn't it?
Yeah, it was raised
it's
up.
Single story, yeah. But it's quite a high single story
there
building.
There is a substantial loft in it, and when we go inside, you'll see. But yeah, there's when you go in the door, you have your main kitchen, like your traditional farmhouse kitchen, and you have a bedroom on one side of the kitchen, and then the parlour room is on the opposite end of the kitchen.
It's very like my grandmother's house, actually.
Oh, it's lovely.
And the thick walls, my goodness. Oh, and the fire is on. That's a gigantic fireplace. So all the crane is still there with all the pots. Would this be a turf area? I presume so.
It is. It was always turf that was burnt here. Dad would always tend lovingly to this house. To this day, he'll always have a fire burning brightly, and just it keeps it in such good condition.
And you have your tins above the fireplace and your horseshoe, and then all the crockery, which we'd see in the farmhouses of Ireland, the blue and white crockery, of course.
This mug rack was actually built in the 1950s by my dad's cousin, Paddy Carey. So Paddy was an electrician, and he was working in Birr at the time. And around that time, rural electrification was happening, but my dad's uncles were a little bit uneasy about getting electricity. There was a lot of fear about it, what electricity was, and you turn on a switch and the whole place lights up, and that was associated with fire rather than electricity. So Paddy was the electrician that was given the privilege of installing electricity into this house, and while he was staying here, he built the mug rack. Now, there would have always been a mug rack hanging, and it's strategically placed inside the door because you had your pump just out in the garden, so you could grab your mug, go out and get your water. These were the everyday crockery, whereas on the dresser, that was the more...
That was for when the priest came round.
And the more ornate delf would be there.
And all the lanterns hanging from the ceiling. There's so much stuff that would have been in use that's just been kept, I suppose.
Yeah, everything that's here has always been here. So it's not like you're coming to a museum, because it's not. It's like the people that have lived here have just stepped out of the house for a few minutes, or they're gone to mass, or they're gone out around the farm. Exactly like it would have been.
When the Egan family moved into a bungalow near the farmhouse, it remained as it was for nearly 200 years. Thinking it had value as a heritage site, Anna Marie was helped by Offaly Heritage Officer Amanda Pedlow to keep the house intact and open it for visitors during Heritage Week. It's always been a social house, and uncles, aunts and grandchildren have gathered here again today.
Lucy is Dad's sister. Lucy comes back to help us out with the Heritage Week events as well, as do my cousins, nieces and nephews. Even the family dog will appear for Heritage Week, as she's done now.
She's come in. Lucy, do you have fond memories of it here then, I must ask you?
I sure have, yeah.
What are the things that stick in your mind when you come back in?
Hard work.
Mm. It was.
Spreading spuds and picking them and doing all that work.
Is it very much like when it was lived in?
Oh, it is. It is. It's not changed, really. The flitches of bacon were hanging up there where the lamps are when we'd kill the pig and the flies happen off it.
And it did you no harm?
No. That's the difference in nowadays. Hygiene.
And do you remember, like, these pots that are behind you there on the hearth, do you remember them being used?
Oh, yeah, well, Breed comes. Anne-Marie's sister comes from Clifton and bakes the bread there.
And so you put the bread in that and it goes down. Does it go onto the turf there?
No, on there. You put the coals. You have to have a good fire. And that's the way.
Making bread on the turf fire is something they still do for Heritage Week. The house has a great collection of family records, recipe books and rare Irish furniture like press beds, a bed that lives in a wardrobe for guests.
You'd have to have a good fire on.
The whole project is a real family effort. And what do people experience when they visit the house?
Bread was lovely.
It's actually a very emotional journey for people to come in, and it's very nostalgic. So you can imagine the house full of people and to keep saying, oh, this reminds me of my mother's house or my grandmother's house. And it really takes people back to their family. And I love this house because it's been a way for our family to connect and reconnect and bring everyone back. But it allows people, when they come to visit, to reconnect with their family in some sort of a way. And then Dad or my Uncle Jim will usually play music at the end of the tour. So it's a really positive, heartwarming experience.
And that was Anna-Marie Egan in conversation with Suzanne Campbell. Now, Storm Ciara is making this weekend feel quite wintry, but there are signs that spring is on the way. And one of those signs is that farmers are allowed to spread slurry on their fields. Dara McCullough joins me here in studio. Good morning, Dara.
Morning, Marty.
Great to have you in the studio. In case anyone is in any doubt, what is slurry?
In short, poo and pee from livestock, yeah, in a tank. We produce 40 million tons of the stuff every year in Ireland because we have so much livestock. And the issue is, how do we handle it? Mm. The first thing is, I suppose, it's got a bit of a whiff off it.
There's a fair smell of slurry.
Yeah, and that's the hydrogen sulfide. And so that's actually quite a dangerous gas. So the first thing is handling it safely in your yard, but also handling it to get it out onto the fields. And, you know, there is this idea in days gone by that slurry was a nuisance and had to be got rid of. But now we realise it's a resource because, of course, it's the perfect circle of the nutrients being recycled on the farm. And as, you know, with every passing year, we realise the risks associated with it in terms of the environment. And the two big issues in terms of handling slurry is basically when you spread it and how you spread it.
Yeah, because there is a closed period, isn't there, for slurry spreading?
And there's a closed period during the winter for two reasons. Very good reasons. Number one, there's very little growth. So, you know, the plants aren't sucking up the nutrients even if you spread it out in the field. And number two, it tends to be shocking wet, as they say up in my neck of the woods,
exactly,
during the winter. And we've just had a winter that proved that in spades.
Now, you visited the farm of John Graham this week in East County Meath. Tell me about John and his farm.
John is a quintessential dairy farmer. He's a father and son set up, John Jr. And they're milking about 100 cows. They haven't expanded madly. They've added on a few extra cows. They're liquid milk suppliers. That means that they're milking every day of the year. So Monday, Sunday, Christmas Day, that milking parlour is turned on twice a day and the two lads tog out. Real honest to goodness farmers. But they're also, even though they haven't expanded widely, they're still spending a lot of money. When we were down there yesterday, there was a new milking parlour. There was new additions onto the sheds, so they're spending.
Well, you chatted to him in his new shed and he told you about how he got on during the close period this winter.
Winter period gone by was very, very difficult. Brought on mainly because of the excessive rain late October. especially and into November. Slurry capacity was put to its maximum because an awful lot of water got into the system that would normally not get into the system, mainly because of a number of deluges that were not expected.
Incessant monsoon-type rain.
Yeah, and a flood of rain came washing down and into the yard that normally would never have happened, but we were caught out.
So that basically flowed into your slurry tanks, effectively diluting your slurry, but using up crucial storage space in there.
Yeah, using up valuable space. We're lucky enough that we have more than adequate storage, but at the same time, I think we'll increase our storage not to be caught out again.
It's an anxious time for a lot of farmers during that closed season when you're not allowed to spread slurry, which is effectively a kind of a three-month season, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a three-month season, and you would be watching for the 16th of January to come around, especially when the tanks are filling, and you'd be watching the weather forecast. You'd be anxious about what the weather is going to do. We're lucky this year that mid-January turned out to be kind enough. Our land dried up quick enough to go out.
But the problem being, if it had started raining again.
Well, that'd be high stress time.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
John Graham there talking to our Dara here. Even when the date on the calendar says it's okay to spread slurry, you still have to have the right conditions, don't you really?
I mean, you'd look out the window this morning and as I was driving in here, beautiful, clear skies, a hint of a frost, nice and you know, the ground starting to dry up. But today wouldn't be a good day to go out spreading slurry because, of course, there's a heap of rain coming this evening and that would just wash it into the nearest stream. So farmers have to be very particular about when they go spreading slurry. They can't spread it when it's either rain is coming or the land is very wet. They can't spread it during a time of the year when there's no crops sucking it up. And they also need to be conscious of how they spread it.
Yeah, and because there has been a big campaign to move farmers from using a splash plate for spreading slurry to using a trailer shoe or injection method. Explain all that to me now.
Yeah, so the classic machine for spreading slurry was a tanker trundling along behind a tractor.
We all saw it.
And what they call a splash plate behind it, the slurry was basically forced out through a hole at the back of the tanker, hit this plate and created a fan at the back of the tanker. And that's created a nice even spread of the slurry across the field. The problem with that system that we're only after realising in recent years is that you've got this big word, volatilisation of gases, which means that a lot of the nutrients, the nitrogen in the form of ammonia and methane, is being volatilized. It's being turned into a gas that escapes into the atmosphere. And ammonia isn't necessarily a greenhouse gas. It's not warming the planet, but it is bad for our health and for the environment. And the methane, of course, is another gas that is bad for the environment. So we have to figure out ways of moving away from the splash plate. And these trailing shoe and dribble bar systems are basically ways around that. So instead of having a plate at the back of the tanker, you have this pipe or bar and the slurry is dribbled onto the ground.
So it doesn't go up into the air.
Correct.
Yeah.
They can be quite convoluted systems. I mean, you know, you could... Fellas are moving away from tankers to, you know, pipes that are miles long. And that's what we actually saw on John Graham's farm yesterday.
And Albert Dernan is a contractor with 50 years experience in slurry spreading. He was an early adopter of the umbilical hose and dribble bar method, which you've just explained. And he showed you how that works.
I can pump slurry from an overground or an underground tank up the field. Today it's 600 metres up the field through a 4-inch pipe.
A huge pipe.
And up to the back of a dribble bar that goes in, it goes into the back of the machine, goes up and into the macerator.
Which is like a mincer.
It's a mincer that just chops everything up and feeds it down into little pipes, 24 little pipes to put it straight down on the ground. Yeah, it flows
leaves
down.
An inch wide strip.
Leaves it in a line on the ground. Gets all the nutrients and everything down onto the ground without air getting into it and taking the good out of it, you know.
That was the problem with the old system, wasn't
it? Yeah, that was the biggest problem, was that it blew it up in the air and the wind got into it and took the smell away across fields and everything and down to houses, and people didn't like it and you weren't getting the same value out of the slurry. This grows the grass for them. It saves them a lot of money from buying fertilisers, and it works. It's cutting back on expense for them.
And I suppose it's the way it should be. You're recycling the
nutrients. You're recycling everything back.
This system seems like a no-brainer, but it's easier said than done.
It is. A lot of the slurry still doesn't suit a trailing shoe or a dribble bar. It doesn't like plastic. It doesn't like dung. It doesn't like bale silage.
So it can block.
It blocks really easy. Too easy.
Is it possible that you could get a better macerator? Is that...
Well, there is an Irish company made, in my mind, they made miles ahead of what I have there now.
Really, yeah?
Yeah, they have a great... They've made it for the Irish conditions. A Cavan company there, Maztec. I think they have the job done properly.
Is there a lot of kind of cutting-edge technology in slurry spreading coming out of Ireland?
Well, there's a lot of companies making it. You have... probably 5-6 companies making this type of gear in Ireland now and exporting it all over the world.
Really? So we're the muck experts.
We have enough of it anyway.
Albert Dernan there. It seems like a really good idea, but not all farmers have changed, Dara. What are the barriers to farmers making that change?
In a word, cost. So, you know, a tanker with a splash plate was an investment for a farmer. If somebody turns around to him and says, listen, you can't use that anymore, you have to buy a dribble bar or an injector system, cost him €15,000, which is where the contractor steps into the mix. So, you know, if the farmer could contract out that job to a fella that, like Albert Dernan, who does it every day of the week, then at least Albert is able to afford the investment.
Is there financial assistance available?
There is, yeah. Because there's a big move on from, you know, at government level, policy level, to try, you know, farming has to reduce its emissions. Mm. And this is one of the ways to do it. So there is assistance out there through TAMS grants.
Loads of texts coming in. The damage that the gases from slurry do, Marty, is huge, and the smell stinks out people's houses. Clothes on the line have to be washed again. Not fair to other people, says Martin in Kilkenny.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the downsides of living in the countryside is that you're going to have these smells at certain times of the year. I mean, the alternative is that we don't spread. We have to spread the slurry because that's the best thing to do with it. And all I can say to that texter is things are getting better because the splash plate is moving out and the dribble bar is coming in, and that does reduce the smells.
Dara McCullough from Ear to the Ground bringing you good news this morning here on Countrywide. And Dara, of course, back on RT1 television on Thursday nights. Thank you for joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
Valentine's Day is next Friday. Make a note. And Brenda Donoghue met a couple this week who do have a very brave thing. They are married and they run a business together. William McHutchin and Cheryl Stanley run a company called Ballyshane Irish Wood Design, where they create beautiful wooden pieces handcrafted from Irish hardwoods. They're also newly married. The Ballyshane studio is based in the grounds of Duckett's Grove Castle, just outside Carlow Town. And when Brenda dropped in, before she talked about working together, she began by asking them, when did they first meet and what can they remember?
Jeez, I don't know what she was wearing, I can't remember that, but I do remember she came for a job interview in a company that I was managing, and I remember seeing her face, and I remember seeing her coming in, and I was like, this girl is going to be trouble.
Sure, did you always like him, if you know what I mean?
I did, actually. I was around 16 at the time. It was the first time I actually met Willie, would you believe? And Willie was working on a house beside a friend of mine's. And I remember just thinking, God, that lad is a good-looking chap. And I went and got all dollied up. I got makeup on and changed my outfit and the whole lot and sat on the wall staring at him. And lo and behold, I didn't realise it was Willie till I was a year in the company. Both of us were working for, and Willie was like, oh yeah, I know, I remember building the house. And I was like, no, there was a really good-looking guy in that house building it. And he was like, that's me. And I was like, no, he was really good-looking.
This is the bandsaw. Everything starts here, so once we start marking out all our boards, everything goes through here, so you can see where our pencil marks are.
Time to visit the workshop where the magic happens. But I wondered, did Willie love wood more than he loved Cheryl?
Yeah, love working with Irish wood, predominantly beech wood. So you can see here the different grains and the different spolt lines. So they're all the same tree, but
the difference in, so this is what you would call flame beech, where it kind of resembles the flame of a fire, and that's actually caused from lime content in the soil. And then you have this flame beech, which is these black zone lines that the tree actually has to fall down on the ground and sit there for a minimum of 2 years for this to start. And the longer you leave it there, so we try to get it after about 5 years, and you get these absolutely gorgeous black zone lines that they just kind of have like stories in themselves and patterns and stuff. So yeah, it's amazing to work with, and yeah, no, I love it.
Have you always worked with wood?
Yeah, in some way or another, yeah. Like, I suppose the background to me getting into this business was because of my dad, who passed away 16 years ago. But I worked with him. He was kind of a handyman and done all that. And then about a month before he passed away, he had said to me that we had a workshop at the back of the house. And he was like, I'd just love to give it all up and try some wood turning and make stuff and do my own thing. He'd worked since he was like 13 or 14 years of age. Then about a month after that, a cousin of mine, he spotted a wood turning magazine, and we had never seen in this shop. It's a local shop and we'd never seen it before. So it was Robert came running to me with this magazine, and it was almost like, oh my God, look at this. So my mum on my birthday bought me a wood turning lathe. And then I spent 8 years in dad's workshop teaching myself how to wood turn. And then I started to get the confidence and start trying to sell the stuff.
And what about you, Cheryl? What's your background? You're in tears.
I mean, yeah, no, oh, it's so sad. Like, sure, William's dad, John, has had a huge part to play in it. Like, it all started out because of John and Willie's wood turning and stuff.
Like, I suppose when I think about it, the coincidence to find a wood turning magazine a month after my dad passed away and to be where I am today because of it, it's something that I got the opportunity to do that he never did.
My background is my two parents own a hardware in Tullow, Ivan Stanley's, and I grew up for years, all my summers and holidays and everything were spent standing on a tin of paint behind the counter, looking after customers and mixing paint and cutting keys, and I know every plumbing fitting you can think of. So from working in my parents' hardware shop, I developed an appreciation for hard work and people working in the craft industry. And from there, myself and Willie, it was just a natural progression that we started our own company, and here we are. Like, it's just fantastic.
So, Willie, when did you know that Cheryl was definitely...
I'd say maybe 2-3 months into the relationship. I said to her, I said, someday I will marry you. And I asked her every single day, maybe 2 times a day, for, 2-3 years?
1,400 times, yeah. To marry you.
Yeah, Cheryl got the numbers. And then, yeah, so 1,400 times. And then the day before I proposed, we were away on holidays in California in Yosemite. And I had asked her, and some days she wouldn't take it lightly, and she'd get a little bit annoyed with me. She'd like, you're never going to marry me.
I was so annoyed that day. I was like, oh, one of these days, Willie.
Yeah. So I said to her, I promise you, tomorrow will be the last day I'll ever ask you. So we went to Yosemite that day and we spent the day. And at 4 o'clock California time, which is midnight in Ireland for New Year's, I got down and Cheryl was looking at, there was a beautiful waterfall in the background, and we were on this beautiful bridge, and there was deers and stuff crossing the river. And I turned around and I called Cheryl, and she turned around and I was on my knee, and I said, today, I told you today will be the last day I ask you to marry me. And she said,
oh,
yes.
Oh, so sweet.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
And it was. And I did say yes that time.
Yeah, yeah. 1,400 times later. Yeah.
So it might as well put you out of your misery.
Yeah.
And I always thought, like, when Willie'd ask me that, I'd be like, you know, I wouldn't cry. I don't know why I didn't think. I said, oh, no, I won't cry. I'll just be like, yeah. Oh, when I turned around and saw him down on one knee, and he had a lovely wooden box that was like engraved out of it, will you marry me? And I just bawled crying. Like, there was so much thought and everything had gone into it, and the location was beautiful. But also just to see this little wooden box that he had carved out, will you marry me? And it was just beautiful. It was really lovely. Like,
I am romantic after all.
Yeah. Sometimes. Look, Willie, I'll oil these boards if you label them ones.
Yeah, okay.
You didn't label that right.
As it's Valentine's week, I could be accused of getting a little bit cheesy by asking Cheryl and Willie what they like about each other.
Oh, Willie's so funny. Like, he is just hilarious. And it's one of the things that I definitely fell in love with Willie over. no matter where we are or what circumstances are, we could be in the middle of setting up a show, a craft show, and everything could be going wrong, and Willie will just turn around and make it hilarious and fun, and the time just passes. But also, he's such a hard worker. Like, you know, we genuinely do work 6-7 days a week, and he never complains. He just gets on with it, and we've created this business because of it, because of his hard work and his determination. And you're sweet. You're lovely. Yeah.
You have that recorded, don't you? Yeah. I want a copy of that. Yeah. Oh God, sure. Like, well, I suppose first of all, like, she's beautiful. She's what you call it. Yeah, but like, she's kind. She's hardworking. Like, the thing is, I always say it, there's never a day goes by that I don't look forward to seeing Cheryl or I want to be with Cheryl. 2 years ago, she went working part time in another company, and those days when Cheryl is not around, like, they were like just so brutal. We have a really good life. Like, we get to work together, we get to enjoy each other's time. We fight and whatnot, but but it's amazing to say that we're running a successful business together, and we're local. We're only a couple of miles from home, and we get to do both things we both love. Like, that's just incredible. Like, you can't get that anywhere.
Cheryl and Willie, in advance, happy Valentine's Day.
Yeah, so hopefully now we have another 40 years of this together. I'm a very lucky guy to say that I get to spend Valentine's Day working with my wife.
And happy Valentine's Day to you too, and Marty.
Yeah, and Marty, yeah. Thanks very much.
Love is definitely in the air. We're all in tears here on Countrywide after listening to Willie and Cheryl, and we wish them and lovers young and old a happy Valentine's Day.